Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. My name is Saif Ahmed and I am joined by Dr. Finbar Slevin. This is the first of a series of podcasts related to an excellent special issue released last month entitled Latest Advances in Endometrial and Cervical Cancer, A Global View. The issue is guest edited by Dr. Sophie Otter and Dr. Alexandra Stewart. And in this podcast, we are joined both by Dr. Otter, a consultant at Royal Surrey County Hospital, who recently spoke to us, in fact, in another podcast about her role within the Clinical Oncology Editorial Board. And we are joined by Dr. Umesh Mahant Shetty, who has authored a fantastic article within the special issue on the incidence, treatment and outcomes of cervical cancer in low and middle income countries.
So just to introduce myself more in detail, of course, I'm Umesh and I'm working as a radiation oncologist and currently heading the institution by name of Homi Bhabha Cancer Hospital. It is one of the peripheral hospitals of Tata Memorial Center, Mumbai. And my area of work is mainly with gynecological cancers and genitourinary cancers, more so with radiation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. I just wanted to start things off, Sophie, by asking you as one of the editors of this fantastic special issue, what do you feel as some of the real highlights that readers should look out for?
Obviously, I think all of the articles are excellent. We try to really keep it broad. So there is a global aspect to it, but there's also trying to cover both cervical and endometrial cancer treatments, long-term toxicities, and also kind of looking ahead to the future, what things are on the horizon for both cancers. So the editor's choice article for this was the article on cervical screening and prevention of cervical cancer. And I know that you're due to speak to Karen Canfell, who is one of the authors of that article, later. So I won't go into it in too much detail, but this was just looking at the WHO initiative to eliminate cervical cancer globally. And it was just a really fascinating article about, you know, the current status and how we might be able to do that in the future. And also, you know, screening for cervical cancer is still going to be important even as people get vaccinated. So just what the screening program may look like in the future, and also some of novel ways of being able to screen for cervical cancer, because one of the things that potentially puts people off that is that they think that smear tests are quite invasive. And so it's just looking at different ways of either self-sampling or providing urine samples. And then also you're going to talk to Umesh shortly. So we found his article looking at the incidence, treatment and outcomes of cervical cancer in low and middle income countries really fascinating, because whilst we still have a problem with cervical cancer in this country as well, and there's still lots more we can do for it, unfortunately, there's a particular burden globally in low and middle income countries. And, you know, the articles looking at technological advances for the treatment of cervical and endometrial cancers are all very good and well, but don't have access to the same kind of, you know, technological advances that we do. So I think that was another particularly interesting article.
Thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Sophie. You refer in your editorial for the special issue to a tale of two halves. Can I ask, what did you mean by that?
Yeah, so obviously this summer, one of the excitements has been the Euros, and football's kind of been at the forefront of people's mind in the UK. And I think this special issue covers both cervical and endometrial cancers. They are anatomically quite close. And so, you know, some of the treatments are similar in terms of radiotherapy, brachytherapy and surgery. And therefore, so are some of the long term toxicities that patients need to live with. But equally, they are quite different cancers. They've got different etiologies. And as I've already mentioned, cervical cancer is predominantly virally driven. And potentially the incidence can be reduced with vaccination and screening, whereas endometrial cancer, the incidence, particularly in developed countries, is linked to obesity and type 2 diabetes. So the incidence of endometrial cancers are increasing. So I think in terms of what we meant about a tale of two halves, we kind of felt that endometrial cancer was winning on some fronts, in that some of the articles touch on being able to stratify endometrial cancer much better using molecular markers rather than the kind of classical TNM staging, and how this can be used both for treatment in the metastatic setting, but also for stratification for adjuvant treatment. Whereas we felt cervical cancer was kind of winning in the second half, in terms of, you know, we do have ways of vaccinating and screening. So hopefully long term, we will be able to eliminate cervical cancer. So that's what we meant by a tale of two halves.
Thank you for that, Sophie. And Umesh, to bring you in on this then, you've written an excellent article with co-authors around the incidence of cervical cancer around the globe. So can you talk us through that a little bit and discuss the true burden of cervical cancer globally?
I was fortunate enough to collaborate with my colleagues from America, who have been working in Africa to some extent, and my colleague from Brazil and Thailand. So when we started compiling this article, it was a challenge, but when we realized that there is a lot of things to report in this article, so we did a collaborative effort of coming up with a common template which can be reported from various countries across various continents. And what we have highlighted in this article is about the incidence, the disparity in incidence across various parts of the world, with a special emphasis on Africa versus Latin America and Asia. And we also try to compile the facilities available for staging evaluation, then the treatment facilities, and some published outcomes from these regions to find out what exactly are we looking at in terms of the cervical cancer burden and the outcome in relation or in comparison to the rest of the world. And to our surprise, the striking differences have been put up in this article, and I'm sure there will be a lot of readers who would come up with a lot of questions and come up with some research ideas how to tackle the cervical cancer burden in low middle income countries, because at least around 90% of the cervical cancer burden today is seen in these low middle income countries. And we have highlighted what are the situations in terms of evaluation, treatment, and outcome from these regions. The major disparity in the incidence is let us say that the incidence is in one number, single digit, in the Western world, as compared to more or less 20 to 40 per 100,000 population in many countries across Africa as well as Asia.
Thanks, Umesh. And just building on that, you said you felt that there were some sort of surprises that came out of when you did the analysis. So that sort of fold difference between the West and the East, I guess, you know, some people might have expected it, but the magnitude is really very, very high. In your view, what were the other sort of surprises that you saw?
One of the major surprises which we encountered was the staging evaluation of these patients. We never thought that many of the countries where the cervical cancer burden is high would not have access to even staging the patients. And to give an example, we found out that less than 40% of the population have access to CT scan as a part of imaging for cervical cancer once they are diagnosed. The other surprise which we also encountered was there are many countries in Africa where the cervical cancer burden is so high, and to above that, most of the patients present at advanced stages, and there are no radiotherapy facilities in the countries for treating these cervical cancer patients. So many countries in Africa does not have even a single linear accelerator or single radiotherapy machine to treat cervical cancer patients. And this was a big surprise to me, thinking about the efforts which have been happening across the globe from various organizations, including International Atomic Energy Agency, NGOs from US, who are trying to come up with radiotherapy facilities. But it was a big surprise that many countries in Africa do not have even a single treatment machine for treating cervical cancer. Above all, there was no question of preventive measures or palliative care when they don't have facilities to investigate. The palliative care facilities and preventive measures was not a surprise at all.
Thank you, Umesh. I mean, those are all really, really powerful messages. I guess, Sophie, on your front, I mean, you're practicing, you know, here in the UK, and sort of reflecting on those kind of figures and information, you know, what are your thoughts, really, hearing those kind of things?
Yeah, I think it's really shocking, isn't it? I mean, I guess, as you said, we know that the incidence is higher in these countries, but when you hear it on that kind of magnitude, and also, as you said, the fact that in some countries there are no facilities for treating any of these patients. And we all know we don't see it that much in this country anymore, fortunately, but we know when these, you know, when pelvic cancers are not treated adequately, they can really cause very nasty symptoms in terms of fistulae, bowel obstruction. It's just really unpleasant to have to deal with that. And we're just very fortunate here that we've got lots of palliative care input. You know, one of the other things that we put in the editorial is that really the treatment of these cancers is multidisciplinary. And again, in a lot of these countries that Umesh is talking about, sadly, people just don't have access to those kinds of things. So I think it's shocking, and we most certainly can do better.
One further question around that, Umesh, just in terms of looking at the data across a number of different developing countries, and low and middle income countries. Did you pick out any sort of real countries where you felt that you kind of surprised to see that data, or was it really sort of around Africa where the problems were? I mean, you know, how does that sort of problem within developing countries pan out?
So as I said, I gave an example, African countries, because many, many, many things are missing in those countries. And what I also forgot to mention was many of these countries, not only in Africa, Southeast Asia, as well as Latin America, there are not even single cancer registry to register cancer patients and find out what is the magnitude of the problem in the country. So this was a major surprise to us, that there are no cancer registry existing in many countries.
Sorry, can I ask a quick question? Umesh, when you said that less than 40% of patients are staged with a CT scan, for example, just out of interest, do these patients, presumably they don't have biopsies either, so the diagnosis of cervical cancer is made clinically?
Yes, most of the countries would rely on diagnosis by a clinical examination and taking a biopsy. And if you go through the WHO report, recent report, to read a biopsy, you need a competent pathologist. And many of these countries had a challenge to get a competent pathologist to read the biopsy. So the biopsy had to be sent across the country to different places and get the report, let's say, by 8 to 10 days. And by then, the patient would not come back for the diagnosis and further evaluation. So the compliance, even for workup, was very poor. So in such situations, just imagine you do a staging, clinical staging, and if you would like to treat this patient, and if these patients have to travel overnight or 24 hours journey to come to a treatment center, you can imagine the compliance to the completion of the treatment, especially for radiation therapy, if they have an advanced disease. Apart from that, what I highlighted was about workup staging was that we were trying to look at even availability of simple ultrasound to find out what is the status of the kidney. That was also available in only 60 to 70% of the population. And that access was also limited to bigger cities and bigger centers, not in the areas where they were diagnosed with cervical cancer. So in such scenarios, you can imagine what would be the compliance of the patients for evaluation and treatment. Forget about rehabilitation. I'm not talking about rehabilitation at all.
Yeah, thank you very much, Umesh and Sophie. You've both highlighted the tremendous discrepancies in the burden of cervical cancer, particularly between high, mid and low income countries, and the associated outcomes that for the disease. What are some of the potential key solutions that could be put in place to try and improve outcomes and improve patient care?
According to me, the key solutions would be the problems which are prevailing in these countries. For example, there has to be a political will. Second, there has to be policies which should be in place, especially in relation to health. And moreover, apart from health, there has to be policies for women health, which is lacking in many of the low middle income countries. This would help to push various policies, which include establishing cancer registries, then having some international collaboration with agencies like International Atomic Energy Agency, WHO, other NGOs which are working towards developing the infrastructure. The fourth point I would like to highlight is awareness and education. I can give an example, a study in India done by Tata Memorial Center, where simple intervention of health education decreased the incidence of HIV and AIDS infection in the community. And the health education imparted was very simple: avoid multiple sexual partners, have safe sexual practices. These few health education material helped to reduce the incidence of HIV and AIDS infection. And according to me, such simple interventions can be implemented across the globe, whether it is low middle income countries or low income countries, which can help to reduce the incidence of cervical cancer, because more or less the preventive measures are similar to what we have been doing in India. And for that reason, I can tell you that in Mumbai city, where we have one of the robust cancer registries, the cervical incidence when I was doing my residency 20 years back was 25 per 100,000, and today it is only 10 per 100,000. And this is not because of vaccination. This is just because of simple health education and improving the hygiene of women who are staying in various, socioeconomic conditions. The other point which would also help to have a good solution to tackle this is that we have to promote equitable allocation of resources. Today, all the low middle income countries are struggling to allocate budgets for health vis-a-vis security or the other economical crisis which they are going through. So if that is in place, I feel that improving the health infrastructure in these countries, especially in rural background, would help even cervical cancer patients to undergo evaluation and diagnosis, and then some treatment which can be implemented at various levels. So these are the few key solutions I feel on a long-term basis to reduce the burden of cervical cancer in low middle income countries. Apart from this, if you see, as mentioned in the article, that majority of the incidence is in rural background, and above all, more than two-thirds of the patients present with advanced disease at presentation. For such situations, definitely we need augmentation of radiotherapy facilities in these regions so that most of the patients can be treated with radiotherapy, if not concomitant chemoradiation, at least radical radiation therapy, so that there is some decent outcome at the end of the treatment for these patients. And for this, IAEA has been working on trying to find out what are the gaps and possible solutions which can be worked on.
Thank you, Amesh. There's some practical points that could be considered certainly there. But Sophie, I wonder, did you have anything to add regarding possible solutions to try and improving the disparity in the burden and outcomes of associated with cervical cancer across the globe?
Yeah, I mean, I think Umesh has outlined most of them and obviously knows a lot more about them than I do. I think it's really interesting to hear how much of an impact education can have. And I think maybe not just on prevention, so kind of, you know, prevention of HPV infection, but also, as you're saying, it's mainly people presenting at late stages. So whether education about the symptoms of cervical cancer and any abnormal bleeding should be checked out, then perhaps that would help with people presenting earlier. And then hopefully the WHO vaccination program will also help to, in the future, reduce HPV infections. It's just really interesting hearing about, you know, the number of radiotherapy facilities. So that's not just going to be having an impact on cervical cancer, but presumably all cancers are there's a problem with treating them. So I guess somehow there needs to be some kind of investment in radiotherapy facilities. And one of the other articles that's in the special issue is an article from, again, Australia, looking at using ultrasound guidance and ultrasound planning for brachytherapy. So I know we're not quite at this level because patients don't even have access to external beam radiotherapy. So presumably access to brachytherapy is even more limited. But kind of the simplification of treatments and using imaging facilities such as ultrasound, which may be slightly more available, may be useful in the future.
So thank you both for really interesting points around that. And I just thought for the final few questions, it would be good to focus on a couple of other aspects that are covered within the special issue. And I think special issue does a great job of really highlighting the sort of global disparity and challenges there, but also looking at sort of opportunities and other advances that we could make in the field of these gynae cancers. So Sophie, if I started off with yourself, looking sort of forward, and where do you feel the most advances are going to be made in the context of improving the lives of patients with these gynae cancers?
So I think, as with all cancers, we're moving more towards molecular stratification, and Peter Hoskins' article within the special issue covers that for endometrial cancer, for patients with high risk endometrial cancer, and talking about adjuvant treatment. So I think that's definitely the way things are going to go. And there's another article by Esther Moss and her team looking at how these can be used for follow-up protocols. So as we've all seen with COVID, things have become a bit more remote in terms of follow-up, and also that's the way that we were trying to go anyway, and perhaps COVID sped that up. But if we can use molecular stratification going forward to decide who's most at risk of a recurrence and having something more intense to follow those people up, but for people who are lower risk based on their molecular stratification, then potentially things could be done remotely. And her article really kind of delves into different ways of following it up, how we can assess those and who may be suitable for different things. And then there's another great article by Susie Banerjee and her team looking at what are future molecular targets for both endometrial and cervical cancers. So, you know, obviously we've already got access to immunotherapy for some endometrial cancers, and it's just looking at other potential targets that we'll be able to use in the future.
Thank you, Sophie. And Umesh, can you tell us a bit more about how gynecological oncology care is being delivered at your centre in India?
For us, India is a unique country because, as you know, we have 1.25 billion population, and of course, 70% of them still are from the rural background. But having said that, let's say I'll give an example of Mumbai city. Mumbai city is an island, and we have at least 15 million people staying in a small island. And the highest number of billionaires in the world stay in that city. And at the same time, half of the population staying in Mumbai city is poor. So Mumbai city medical practice is really unique in the sense that we have to cater for the entire spectrum of the population with cancer. And that is the model which we are working at Tata Memorial Center, and where we cater for richest person in the city to the poorest person in the city. And believe me, there is no difference in the treatment offered to these patients based on the type of cancer they have and the stage they have. That sort of cancer care we are trying to disseminate across the country. And to that effect, I can tell you that we have now almost 8 satellite cancer centers under the umbrella of Tata Memorial Center, distributed across the country in the north, south, northeast, west and east, where similar concept of cancer care is being offered to these patients. By doing this, we are trying to disseminate, guidelines or protocols which can help all these centers to have uniform treatment protocols for all the patients who visit the cancer hospital. And not only this, apart from Tata Memorial Center coming across the country, we also have something called as National Cancer Grid. And through this grid, we are inviting all the cancer centers who are treating cancer patients in this country to come under this grid. And through this grid, we are coming up with consensus protocols which can be implemented across the whole India uniformly, so that the aim of affordable and sustainable cancer treatments can be offered to every patient who is diagnosed with cancer at their doorsteps. So this is the sort of plan which we have in place through Tata Memorial Center and the National Health Policy today. So similar strategies and interventions can be implemented in various countries where, looking at the example of India, it may be practical to do it more in smaller African countries, Latin American countries, and other LMICs which are also in Southeast Asia. And to this, maybe there was a proposal to expand this national cancer grid to international cancer grid, where neighboring countries like Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and other countries in Southeast Asia are also planning to join. By doing this, we intend to at least push uniform treatment protocols across the various countries, and this would be really advantageous for treating cervical cancer, where it is still a major cancer in women in these regions.
I just wanted to ask for my own understanding, really. How that sounds fantastic, and it sounds exactly the way that other countries should go. How is that funded in India?
Yeah, that is a big issue. Funding comes from the Department of Atomic Energy for us, for Tata Memorial Center. So it is public funding, number one. Number two, the National Cancer Grid is funded by the National Health Policy. So it is supported by the funding from the government of India. Having said that, we have a lot of centers, cancer centers, who are running a private hospitals, but they are still part of National Cancer Grid. And through this, we are trying to, monitor the cost of treatment across the country, so that every person can visit these hospitals and can afford the treatment in an easy way. Having said that, the other initiative which the Government of India has already taken is the health policy has become stronger now. So a lot of rural population have access to the insurance, the government insurance, through which they get best of the treatment in best of the hospitals available. The only major hurdle is, do they really want to travel long distances and come for treatment? So that is being worked out on something called as hub and spoke model, where we are trying to come up with various spokes with one hub at the center. And through these spokes, at least the initial evaluation workup is done. And then if this patient really requires, supra-major treatment, then these patients are taken to the hub from the spoke. So this model, probably I'll be able to give you more details in 5 years down the line when we have many spokes which are functional currently with some data.
That's really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, Finn or anyone else?
No, I don't think so. It was a really interesting discussion. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
So Umesh and Sophie, thank you very much for joining us. It's been really fantastic to hear your expert insights on this topic.
Thank you.
Thank you.